Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM, Seattle. The best in true crime, conspiracy, and history with Al Warren and Kev Thompson.
Hey, good evening. I want to welcome you to my very first edition of Stephen's Commentary. It's indeed an honor to be with you this evening. Each week we will discuss a mysterious aspect of true crime, forensics, or some related topic. Tonight we're going to talk about just how is it that a police detective knows someone is lying to them. This is going to be part one of a two-part series. I want to start out first by giving you a couple of tidbits about liars and lying. Did you know that in the first 10 minutes of meeting someone new that you will hear 2 to 3 lies? In January, more people lie than any other month. And depending on the circumstances, of course, but if you stay in the bed all day long, this won't apply to you. But the average person can hear up to 200 lies per day. Per day. It's amazing, folks. 200 a day. Before we get started, I need to explain some misinformation that's is out there. One of the biggest misconceptions that I have come across in my many years of law enforcement and general living, is for that matter, is that people will tell me, Steve, I know how to tell a liar because when I talk to them, if they don't look me in the eyes, then they're lying to me. Folks, listen, if that is what you're using to determine if someone's lying to you or not lying to you, stop it, please. You're doing yourself and the person you're talking to a gross injustice. Let me tell you something. People who have Asperger's are not usually comfortable looking you in the eye. People who have PTSD may not be comfortable looking you in the eye. Those with low self-esteem or who are shy are not comfortable sometimes looking you in the eye. If you're using the not look at me in the eye indicator that all people are lying to you, quit, please, please. Now, having said that, is not looking someone in their eye an indicator of lying? Yes, of course. But it's not the only tool you have in your basket. If you're using that as the one-size-fits-all indicator to determine if someone's lying to you, you're doing everybody a gross injustice. Detectives use clusters of indicators. The more indicators, the better. All right, now that I've said that, let's move on. Let me tell you something that may amaze you, and I'm being facetious. People lie to police officers. Yeah, I know, right? But how does a detective know when someone's lying to them? Let's use this case in point. Let's say that a detective has brought a suspect in for questioning in a robbery. After some questioning, the detective just point blank asks the individual, "Did you rob the store?" Now let's say that the suspect says, "No, I did not rob the store." And then let's use another scenario where the suspect says, "No, I didn't rob the store." Now, one of those statements indicates a lie. Is that the only thing we use to go by to determine? Of course not. Just like looking at someone in the eye when they talk to you. But it's one indicator. Now, if the suspect said, "No, I did not rob that store," that is an indicator that he or she is lying to the detective. Why is that? Suspects will typically not use words with contractions. It's just one of those things. They typically will not use words with contractions. They will say each word out. They will say, "I did not rob that store," instead of saying, "No, I didn't rob the store." That's just one indicator. Another indicator that police detectives use is elusion. It's when the suspect is asked a question, but they allude to their innocence. They just don't come right out and say it. They don't come right out and say, "No, I'm innocent," or "I didn't do it." They will allude to their innocence. For instance, if asked, "Did you lock the store this time?" instead of saying, "Yes, I did not," or "No, I did not lock the store," they will say, "Well, I always lock the store." "Well, maybe in the past you did, but we're talking about this time." So what they will do is they will allude to their innocence. All right, another indicator that police detectives will use is eye shift. You're going to have to know whether this person is right-handed or if this person is left-handed. And that's, of course, fairly straightforward and easy to do in an interrogation or interview setting. If the person is right-handed and they look upper right after being asked a question, that is an indicator that that person is trying to concoct a story where a story previously did not exist. In other words, a lie. They're trying to create a story for the question. If the person is right-handed and looks upward left, that is an indicator that they are trying to remember a situation that did occur, or the truth. Now, just the opposite is true for someone who is left-handed. If you have a suspect who is left-handed, he or she looks upper left, that is an indicator that they are trying to concoct a story where one previously did not exist, just like the right-handed person looked upper right. If the left-handed person looks upper right, that indicates that they are trying to remember a situation that did occur, or the truth. Now, again, I can't emphasize this enough. Is that the only indicator, and is that alone enough to decide that a person is lying? No, not at all. By all means, no. But there are indicators. Now, these are just a couple of the indicators that we will discuss, and we'll discuss more next week and go into more detail about a couple other indicators that you can use or that investigators use to determine if someone's lying. I would like to thank you for your time. I would also like to urge you to invite others to listen in to the House of Mystery radio show each week. My name is Stephen Lampley. I'm glad to be here, glad to be your host, and glad to spend time with you. You have a great evening.
Hello, this is 911. We just received a call from this number. Is everything all right?
No, I think someone's in my house.
Can you see the person at this time, sir?
No, I think he's in the fucking living room.
Okay, listen closely. I'm going to have to move you to a safer place in your house. I've dispatched officers to your location. Where are you right now?
The Tucson Murders True Crime Tours offers historic crime investigations into forgotten, lost crimes in Tucson, Arizona. To book your tour, call 520-323-3406 or email info@thetucsonmurders.com. Did he make it? Book your tour and find out.
Hi everybody, welcome to the House of Mystery and the paranormal segment of the show. I'm thrilled today to be able to talk to who is fast becoming an old friend, John D'Souza. This is the second time that we've had the pleasure of having a conversation about John's life and his experiences. And, you know, probably over a year has gone since our last discussion. Lives change, things move on, we experience different things. So just to recap, for those people who aren't aware of John, John has an exceptional history in the FBI as an investigator, working with anti-terrorism, violent crime. But then events happened around 9/11 that really made John rethink and start to explore his own understanding of the paranormal. And John, I don't think I talked about this with you last time we spoke.
Yes.
Because you were interviewing the Indigo children who had had experiences leading up to 9/11.
Yes, absolutely, Julie. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be on here with you again. And yes, I am. I'm John D'Souza. I was a special agent of the FBI for over 25 years. During that time, I worked some high-profile terrorism cases, violent crime cases as well. And yeah, when 9/11 rolled around, we had a tremendous, in law enforcement, we had a tremendous experience of what I call the Indigo Kids of 9/11. Yeah, that's right. They were little kids as young as, like 4 or 5 years old, going all the way up to 12, dozens and dozens of cases of these kids across the states, across the United States, who were called in after 9/11 happened, who were called in as having information about the events of 9/11 before it happened. And they were called in to these intelligence centers where people were told, call in anything that seems suspicious at all. And they were called, these kids were called in. An example, we had a little girl who was just playing on a playground, and she was just by herself, just playing during recess. And teacher comes up to her and says, are you okay? You're not playing with the other kids? And she said, no, I'm just thinking. And she's tracing designs in the dirt. And then teacher goes to walk away, figures she's fine. And little girl tugs on her skirt violently and says, tomorrow, stay away from tall buildings. Tall buildings sometimes fall down and they fall on people. And then the next day, 9/11 happened in the States. Had another little boy who was finger painting in class, very young child. He was finger painting in class. He was drawing these beautiful structures, and this teacher's assistant comes up to him and says, wow, these buildings, these are beautiful. You have these two tall buildings that you drew, and there's angels flying out of these buildings with red wings. And the little boy says, when she says, these buildings are glowing. It's beautiful how they're glowing. And he says, the little boy says, these buildings aren't glowing. These buildings are on fire. And those aren't angels with red wings. Those are people who are jumping out of the buildings, and they're on fire as well. And, you know, a teacher walks away from a kid like that and just doesn't think about it again until then 9/11 happens. And then she reports that in. So we had dozens and dozens of those cases that occurred, that happened, that just were amazing. And they all had to be investigated by FBI agents, police officers, all these task forces that worked together in these intel centers. And we had to respond to these cases, and we had to talk to these poor little kids, some of them sometimes who barely even remembered the experiences at the time. But there were numerous of these cases, and every one of them had to be investigated and had to be spoken to. And in every single case came back, the families had to be looked into, and there was no connection to terrorism found. In other words, it wasn't like these kids overheard some adults planning 9/11 or anything like that. That was all looked into, and these families were found to have no connection whatsoever. So, in other words, the paranormal explanation of their experiences was the only explanation left.
And subsequent to that experience, I mean, the FBI clearly must have been quite taken aback by the sheer volume of those children needing to be interviewed and having these almost premonitions. So now, is there anywhere that the FBI collate information prior to an event? So if children especially those children in particular, are still drawing things and saying, explaining things in such a way. I mean, most children do not draw buildings with people jumping out of them and on fire. Right. So is there a way of collating this information prior to an event and analyzing it?
Prior to an event? Well, not with the FBI. The FBI does not have a separate sort of division or unit to look into these things or to separate cases that have paranormal impact or implications to them. And if people want to see what I'm talking about, they can easily just go to a website called vault.fbi.gov. And just go to vault.fbi.gov, and you just go there, and you just click on a place on the right where it says unexplained phenomena. And then you'll see opened up all the different categories of paranormal investigations that have happened over the years in the last, going back 40 years. This is the website that has all the declassified cases investigated in the FBI. And there are categories under unexplained phenomena that shows cattle mutilation cases that have been investigated by the FBI across Montana, Utah, Wyoming, across many of the states. Also, there's sections under unexplained phenomena for UFO investigations. And there's numerous under that category. There's numerous investigations. And also there's an entire JFK section, of course. There's JFK assassination section in there. And many people have been on this site and have looked. You don't need a middleman. You can just go directly. But what this site shows is what I'm telling you now, that paranormal, there's no separate unit or section for paranormal investigations. Mm-hmm. They're just handled in the broad general sense as regular investigations. And if you start looking at these investigations under unexplained phenomena, on the right-hand column that you'll see in that site, you'll see that they're handled as purely material, physical investigations. For instance, the cattle mutilation cases, even the UFO cases, they're handled as regular material cases, and they're run out to the end until the material data runs out. And usually on a lot of these cases, they end up undetermined status at the end of it all, because the FBI officially can't go beyond the material conclusions. They can't. They're a criminal organization, and they can't go beyond that last step into being, you know, para investigator. They can't go beyond that. That's the reason why I put together a lot of these cases in my book when I left the FBI, the para investigators. And that's why I had to collect these information. So basically to put together these investigations, I'm it. I'm the one who collects these cases and puts them together and shows them to people, like I did in my book, The Para Investigators.
And prior to the 9/11 and that experience that you had, were you interested in the paranormal or extraterrestrial life before that, or was it something that kind of that event triggered
your interest? The opposite is true, because I had involvement in the paranormal and extraterrestrial type investigation even before I was an FBI agent. As a matter of fact, some of my experiences as a child and through my teen years are one major reason why I decided to become a professional investigator in order to pursue a lot of these paranormal themes that came up with me when I was younger. This, I think last time I was on your show, as a matter of fact, this is something that is recounted in my book, The Extra Dimensionals. When I was about 10 years old, when my parents brought me to a place, brought me to a party in New York City, where I was at a party with hundreds of people in a certain neighborhood, and me and a bunch of other little kids who didn't want to be in the party anymore, we kind of started playing with each other and we spilled out into the night. It was about 1 a.m. And it was in New York City, and it was in a neighborhood with some tall buildings, and we went out playing in the streets, which were deserted at that time. And I ended up by myself between two tallest buildings I've seen to that time. And I looked up, and it was a very starry night, very beautiful starry night. And it was one spot above my head that was completely black. It was very dark, inky black dark. And I kept looking at that spot, and it was a cloud, like the type of a squid would give off in the water of just when you're trying to grab it. And it was just a dark cloud of inky black. And from the bottom of that cloud started coming out some spotlights. And I kept looking at that cloud, and it was a flying saucer. It was an old-fashioned UFO just coming down towards me with spinning lights in the bottom, and appeared metallic, sort of. I mean, it looked that way. And it was coming down towards me, and I felt that spotlight go through me, that blue-green spotlight that I've spoken to. Many witnesses have felt that spotlight, and it feels like it just is just going through you, examining everything in you. And I just looked up at it, and then two girls appeared on my left, who were screaming, teenage girls, who were looking at the same thing I was, and they were screaming and going crazy. And one of them yelled at me, "Little boy, you better run home. The world might be ending." And then they disappeared, and I took a step back out of the spotlight, and the UFO reversed course at the same moment and just started going right back up into that dark cloud, and it just started just taking off and disappeared, and it disappeared, and the cloud was gone too. And I ran back to the hall, hall where they were having the party, and I ran back to my parents and told them what happened. And my mom told me, "You can't talk about those things in front of people," so I had to wait till we got home and told them everything that occurred. And it wasn't received very well, but that was my first experience at about the age of 10. And that was my first experience at that age. And that continued, that basically started my interest in the paranormal and in extraterrestrials as well.
Then the definition of paranormal is just as it sounds, it's something outside of the realms of what we believe to be normal. And it doesn't cover any particular genre of sort of extraterrestrial or spiritual presences or poltergeist activity. It doesn't cover any one aspect. So what are your beliefs, John, in particular around the presence of spirits or extraterrestrials?
Well, you know, because of how much I've researched and I've looked into these cases and the witnesses I've talked to, the witnesses I've spoken to over the years, I basically have come to a complete belief that all persistent areas of the paranormal that have really lasted in the consciousness of people over the years are basically truthful, serious nonfiction. I believe that ghosts, cryptids, spirits, alien visitors, and any phenomena that persists in the mind of man has basically its roots in truth. You know, and that's because human consciousness wouldn't keep pushing these things forward if there wasn't something rooted in truth. And that's been my experience as I investigate these things and as I go through drilling down, because all I am is an investigator and all I can do is, and I don't have a dog in this fight. You know, all I can do is go with what the evidence shows and the clues and the patterns and the modus operandi and where it sends me, where it takes me. And it's different from scientists though. Scientists have to follow the data, the material data, until it runs out. And once the material data runs out, they can't go any further. Investigators are different. We follow the clues. Follow the clues and follow what happens in the minds of people. And that very often goes beyond the material. It takes us to places that can be very improbable and very unbelievable. But we have to be ready when we get there to examine those and to take them as serious, truthful nonfiction, basically.
And of course, so many paranormal investigators, and I use the term loosely, will go seeking activity, whether that be ghostly activity, spirit, or whether it be extraterrestrial. And they'll go out looking and hunting and having these overnight investigations in places where maybe there never has been any reported activity. But as you were saying, a good paranormal investigator, a good investigator, they go out and they investigate somebody else's experience. So somebody has felt that, they've lived and breathed that experience, and no matter how they've interpreted it, they have experienced it at a particular time on a particular day, and so you go back and you investigate that at a similar time, similar day, etc., rather than people who just go out willy-nilly overnight and just call out for random things to happen.
Absolutely. As investigators, you've got to follow the clues, match up the patterns. You've got to look and develop the modus operandi. What's happening? How do these things, the same way that you would investigate a criminal or a potential criminal, you have to develop that profile. You have to, even if what you're looking at is ghosts, or alien visitors, you have to treat it like they're perpetrators. And then you have to build that modus operandi. Why do they act the way they do? Is there a perpetrator here or not? And there's so much that goes into this with experienced investigators as far as building up that profile, building up that personality profile to what is involved with these phenomena. And whether there is a phenomena there or not, you know, very often you have a body. Well, in criminal investigations, you have a body that's dead and that's been obviously murdered. But now you've got to find who is the culprit, where is the culprit, and what is our reason for believing that culprit is the person. Well, finding out whether Bigfoot is real or not, or whether ghosts are really there, is very similar. It's very similar in terms of temperament and how you approach that whole thing. And it's something that people need to really, really get away from the scientific approach, which doesn't tell you anything in the paranormal. It only tells you what exists in the material world. And only real investigation can get beyond that.
If you had to go back and think about one experience or case that you've investigated of alien visitation that told you quite clearly, this has got to be true, this has got to happen, this has got to be, there is definitely another layer of life form out there, what case would it be?
Oh, that's easy. I'd have to narrow it down to three cases, actually. And these are the three cases that I always present in my presentations whenever I travel all over the country and give conferences to people. These are the three cases that I happen to know personally are absolutely authentic extraterrestrial cases of UFO visitation, and that's why I present them I dissect them very carefully in my book, The Extra Dimensionals, and I talk to people about these cases wherever I go, especially because they're available on video. Anyone can see them, and millions of people actually have seen them. But unless you know the background behind why they are authentic, you can't really appreciate those cases. So I don't know if are we up against the break or no?
You carry on.
Okay. The three cases are I'll tell them in chronological order. These are cases that I personally know through documentation, through government contacts, through different things in my own history. I know these cases are absolutely authentic, and anyone can look them up. It is, number one is the 1996 Tether incident. Anyone can Google the Tether incident, and there are many videos available that people can go look at and see this. The 1996 Tether incident is basically when NASA had the previous policy of just having open server. And, I always tell people also just to Google NASA cuts the live feed, and you'll come up with dozens of cases, dozens of videos of NASA cutting the live feed of their satellites. And, of course, they manage satellites in the upper atmosphere of the Earth and many satellites. And NASA has a standing order that whenever an unknown UFO comes into view of these satellites that are showing that they don't know anything about, an unknown UFO, they will cut the live feed, of course, so that people can't see it. That's part of their job, and they do it very well. But the 1996 Tether incident was one when they didn't cut the live feed quickly enough. And we had the ISS was out in space. It's a massive satellite platform. And it had put out a cable, directly out into space. The cable snapped, and it was supposed to be a loop, but instead it snapped loose, and it went directly out into space. And it's for 6 miles. 6 miles. It was sticking out straight into space, and it was acting as an antenna, giving off both electrical and magnetic energy put together. It was an experiment. And it apparently acted as some kind of a distress signal, because suddenly dozens and dozens of UFO vehicles appeared from all corners of space there and came over to see what was going on with this antenna. And some of them were massive in size. And the video is available. Anyone can see it. NASA tried to debunk their own video, of course. They tried to say it was, the best they could do is say it was ice crystals. That was it. But you could clearly, anyone can look these up at any moment, and you can clearly see UFOs that are, some of them appear to be about a mile in diameter. They're huge, but many are smaller and just zooming and coming through. Some of them are slowing down. Some of them are changing direction, but there's dozens of them, and they are all coming over to see what is happening with this antenna. And some of them, many of them, are giving off energy signals. You can clearly see them giving off energy pulses in front, not in back, but in front. In other words, it's not propulsion. It's some kind of scanner that is going on with all of them, where they are scanning the area. And so to say that NASA's attempt to debunk by saying these were all ice crystals is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But people need to see this video for themselves, and they will know. They'll know exactly what these things are. So that's the first incident that I know for certain is absolutely authentic and is at non-terrestrial UFOs. And I know that for a fact. And that was the 1996 Tether incident. And I encourage people to look that up, of course, on their own. The second one is the Turkey UFO. The Turkey UFO, the country of Turkey, UFO of 2008. 2008. Also, it's called the, it's also called the, and anyone can Google these and watch many videos that are available out there, on this and, on, of course, on YouTube. And it's also called the Visible Occupants UFO, the physical, and there's a reason for that, because it's the only UFO case. And people know these cases. What they don't know about, people know these cases, so millions of people have looked at these videos, but what they don't know is that these cases are absolutely authentic. Because, of course, there is an apparatus set up to debunk these cases and these videos. And that apparatus is very efficient because it involves the mainstream media. It involves these squads that create fakes that replace the authentic videos temporarily. And there's a whole – that's a whole nother topic. But anyway, I encourage everyone to Google the Turkey UFO. 2008, also the Visible Occupants UFO, because that is a video that has been certified as authentic by every scientific board in the country of Turkey, and is basically just a security guard who filmed out in sky this UFO that was, it's very far away, but you can tell that it's real, and the UFO for some reason there's like a plexiglass bubble in the middle, and it's clear, and you can clearly see two, what appears to be grays standing in the clear plexiglass part in the middle. And that's the best way I can describe it, but that's what it looks like. And it's the first time most people have seen actual grays, that gray beings that are standing in the middle of this UFO. And that's a second case that I absolutely know is authentic, that people can see for themselves. And they'll also see, of course, they'll also see the faked videos, because that's part of what is done to try to debunk these cases. And the third one that I would encourage people to also look up, which I know is absolutely authentic, is the 2011 Dome of the Rock UFO. Dome of the Rock UFO. Anyone can Google that, and you can see numerous videos of that incident. And it is when it is in 2011 in January when a plasma UFO came down in the night sky. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning in Jerusalem, Israel, and this plasma UFO filled with light just came down directly over a Islamic holy site, the Dome of the Rock, and it's also a Jewish holy site as well. And it came down directly over there. It hovered directly over the Dome of the Rock for about 30 seconds, and then almost as if it was delivering something, and then it gave off an energy flash, an energy signal that covered all of Jerusalem. Just like that, and then just went straight up into the night sky and disappeared at a speed that is not humanly possible, and it just took off and disappeared. And that was the 2011 Dome of the Rock UFO that people should just look up, as the videos are available on YouTube. However, let me say, on each of these cases, there is a procedure that is followed by the elite powers in control, the puppet masters, who are very anxious to cover up any true incidents of the paranormal. And what they do is they have these standing squads that look up these any real incidents of the paranormal or of UFOs, and they will take down the originals temporarily, because this is viral. They take down the originals, the real videos, and then they load up fake copies, so that when millions of people, because millions of people heard about this, people even in the mainstream heard about this, and you have millions of people in 2011 in January, millions of people found out about the Dome of the Rock UFO and rushed to YouTube to go see the videos. Well, they didn't get to see the real videos, which were taken down. What they got to see were the, and this has happened in every one of these instances, and what they got to see were these fakes that were created, sometimes with Hollywood-level level quality. And the fakes were created, but with traces of CGI and Photoshop and bad fakes on purposely. And they were created and loaded up there so that when these millions of people all rush to go see Dome of the Rock UFO, Dome of the Rock UFO, they'll be confronted with these fakes. And then they will say, and also at the same time, the Huffington Post and New York Times are all sent to go look at the fakes that were loaded there during this crucial period, this about 48 hours after the incident. And they will go look, and then they will write articles pronouncing that this was fake, it never happened. Oh, look at the CGI, look at the Photoshop, these are terrible fakes, this incident never happened. Okay. Then all the millions of people see those articles, and they also see the fakes, and then they all conclude, and many people remember this, that the 2011 Dome of the Rock UFO was a fake. It was absolutely not true at all, and a poor fake at that. Then the awakening is averted, and everyone forgets about it. Well, of course, because it's viral, the original, the real videos get loaded back up because it's viral. And so the elite powers in control can't stop that from happening. But it doesn't matter. And as a matter of fact, the real videos are up there right now. Anyone can go see them, and they are available. But that crucial period was avoided, that crucial period of awakening, like right after it happened. And that's their real purpose. That's all they want. They don't care if people who are already awakened, like us and like your audience, Julie, if they see the real videos now, they don't care because we're in that little minority of awakened people. What the elite powers in control care about is interference with the mainstream. They're those millions, millions, millions of people that are don't know if the paranormal is real or not, but you know, they'll check out something just to see if it has any validity to it. And that's the period when they need to avoid people seeing the real stuff. And they did. And they did, not just in this case, but in each one of these cases, the Turkey UFO 2008 case has numerous fakes that were loaded up there right after it happened. And the originals were taken down. And the Tether incident had a huge campaign from NASA and mainstream news to debunk it being authentic UFOs. And this will always happen. This will always happen because the paranormal and ufology is an area that the elite powers in control are desperate to cover up. They are desperate to avoid any kind of possible awakening that could happen as a result of this area.
So it's very X-Filesy, and I know you're known to be the kind of the real Fox Mulder. But when we're thinking about this whole conspiracy and what is real and what isn't real, we have that situation where we have the extraterrestrial or the paranormal. Then we have the bodies that try to dismiss and debunk those theories or that reality. How do we know that it's not actually the extraterrestrials, the beings that are more in control, and they're almost staging all of that?
Oh, it is absolutely them, because here's how it happens. We have the puppet masters of humanity that I call the elite powers in control. They're not in control of us. They're in control of their own institutions. They're global institutions. But they are, and I don't like to say deep state or use other people's phrases, but I call them the elite powers in control. And they are working together with a segment of alien visitors who are the... And this is stuff I have gathered from other people in the intelligence community that are a lot more experienced than I am. And these elite powers in control, they work together with a segment of malevolent alien visitors. And what first told me that was the actual reality of Roswell, what happened at Roswell, New Mexico, where we had in 1947, I believe it was 1947, the alien, the very carefully composed disinfo psychological operation of Roswell, where we had this this supposed alien vehicle and alien technology that was crashed on the ground, and supposedly a couple of alien bodies that were retrieved from that incident. And as I tell in my book, The Extra Dimensionals, the a real careful investigation of that incident shows that this was a psychological operation composed by, with help from alien visitors and the elite powers in control that, that give the nations their marching orders every day. And what they did was they put together some alien, some real alien tech and some materials, and then they put together some kind of hybrid bodies that were put into there. And part of, and there were many purposes to this operation, this psychological operation, because it wasn't really aliens in there. It was some kind of hybrid bodies, and it wasn't really an alien ship, but it was made to look that way. And here's the interest that the alien visitors had in doing that. And it's a segment of the alien, this malevolent alien visitors that were involved in this. The reason is they want people to think that alien visitors are physical, just like human beings. They want, that's a very important agenda item for them, because it goes into alien imminency. It goes into a lot of important agendas that they care about. They don't want people to think that alien visitors are not physical, as I reveal in my book, The Extra Dimensionals. Alien visitors are actually not physical. They are from other dimensions. They can apparently change their vibration to be here sometimes physically for short periods, but that's something that's very temporary, and they have to go back to their own dimensions of reality. However, they want us to, then that's why Roswell happened. They want us to think that they are physical, that they could be here, they could show up on the White House lawn at any moment, set up camp, and they could just be here forever. And they can't. That's one of the things that they are very much interested in hiding and keeping people from knowing, because then it leads to other revelations about them that they would rather keep under wraps. And that's one of my investigative conclusions from everything that happened at Roswell concerning extra dimensionals.
So what's the ultimate goal? If extra dimensionals are in control of everything that we do and they're manipulating world events, what's their bigger purpose?
Oh, that's the ultimate question. Their bigger purpose is what it's always been. Even people who disagree on the nature of alien visitors tend to agree on this one point. Their ultimate purpose is connection to human souls. And what's funny about that is that that applies whether you're talking about, and there's really only two groups of alien visitors that matter, malevolent alien visitors who seek to harm us, seek to subjugate us, seek to do bad things to us, and benevolent alien visitors, the good ones that come here, help us, serve us, heal people's diseases, cure us, and do great things for us. And yet both groups all seek connection to human beings on a spiritual level. That's what they seek. That's very important to them. And it's what they've always wanted. It's what they always seek out. And again, like I said, there's both groups. There's the malevolent alien visitors and there's benevolent ones, the good ones. And if you want to see the malevolent ones, just go on, you can just go on YouTube and look at any of the interviews with Betty and Barney Hill. Those are malevolent alien visitors who are doing great harm to people, and those with alien abductions. and with the everything that surrounds alien abductions. And you can see those interviews. They're still available. They're in black and white. Betty and Barney Hill talking about their experiences, especially the ones that show after they underwent hypnosis and revealed a lot more of the details. And these are people who are absolutely authentic in their testimony. You can see it, you can hear it when you listen to them and you hear them talking about what happened to them. They never were seeking fame. They were never seeking anything, but they told their story once they were forced to, and you can tell that they're telling the truth. You can tell that they're absolutely authentic. And those are the malevolent alien visitors, the ones that are doing harm to people. But I've also talked to witnesses that have experiences with benevolent alien visitors who come to them, help them, uplift them, and again, cure diseases, conditions that they had, and make them better people. And, you know, you have to know them by their fruits so that you can know that these are the two types of alien visitors that really matter. And they're the only two types that matter. So we have to figure out how to avoid contact with the malevolent alien visitors and how to reach out to the benevolent ones.
In terms of that kind of greater control, do you believe that aliens or extraterrestrials, whatever we want to call them, are responsible for our terrorist attacks? Or, you know, just our day-to-day living? I mean, how much control do they really have?
They have control over what they want to have control over. For instance, through the elite powers in control, for instance, they have, and it has nothing to do with our day-to-day living or and what it has, what control that they have is that since 1947, there has been a worldwide order that applies to the British government, applies to the United States government, and applies to all the national governments. And that worldwide order is you shall not allow to be revealed anything true or authentic about UFOs or alien visitors. And that has been a worldwide order that has been in effect since 1947, and it has been obeyed, basically, because the national governments, they follow orders too, and they do what they're told. And if anybody doesn't know what I'm talking about, all you got to do is Google NASA cuts the live feed, and you'll see dozens of examples of people who don't have to wait for a new order. They know what to do. They cut the live feed as soon as that unknown UFO shows up in the satellite feed. And what's funny about that is all the other space agencies do the same thing. European Space Agency, the Japanese, the Indian, as soon as an unknown, and you can Google that too, and ESA, European Space Agency, cuts the live feed and it's out there. Because there are people who sit there and record these things, and then they get out there virally, and they won't go away, no matter what the ESA does. So this is a worldwide order. We also saw it at Rendlesham Forest when we had an American military base on British soil that was invaded in 1980, invaded by numerous UFOs that came. They shut down nuclear missiles, and they also invaded the entire base. These terrified soldiers that were confronted with these UFOs at night. It was an incredible experience. And yet, the United States and the British government immediately began the cover up of everything that happened, including even threatening the colonel in charge of the base and threatening all of the soldiers that were involved. That's because no one has to wait to be, they already have the order, the British government, the United States government, they already have the order that they must do everything possible to cover up anything authentic about UFOs and alien visitors. They don't have to wait for additional orders. They already know that cover up is always immediate. and no further orders have to be given.
Is that because they just want to withhold the truth because of the consequences, or is it because that's being controlled by alien life form in the way that we learn about them?
Wow, you're a good lawyer. Yes, that's the next natural question. The reason for that worldwide order that has been in effect since 1947, that for the governments not to allow anything real to be disclosed about alien visitors or UFOs, the reason for that order is because alien visitors, well, segments of alien visitors, want to be the only ones to reveal themselves when the time comes. They don't want any other middlemen involved. They don't want any other details of themselves to be revealed before that crucial time, because disclosure by governments is not a real thing. Governments don't have the real plan. They don't have the real agenda of alien visitors. They don't have anything that can really be disclosed. They have mountains of data. They have lots of data about UFOs and alien visitors, but they don't have the central thing that shows what they are, who they are, and what their purpose is. No one has that. That's why disclosure movement is not real. It's not something that will ever happen. But what is going to happen is what the alien visitors are planning. Because from everything I've seen, from every investigation I've done, it all comes back to the same central conclusion, which is that alien visitors are going to do revelation of themselves directly to us. And it won't go through the governments. It will go directly to us, people who are open to that sort of revelation. And that is what they're planning. That is why they have always had this order in effect. That is why they don't want any middlemen or any government people getting involved in revealing anything about them, because they are going to do revelation themselves directly, and they don't want any interference with that. That's the only conclusion I keep coming back to over and over again, no matter how many of these investigations I do. That's the only visible purpose that I can see behind them making sure that they hold back this information. And I think because of where we are, I think we're getting to that point very soon where revelation, not disclosure, but revelation will happen and will involve all of us, Julie.
Because, of course, as we're seeing or hearing accounts from alien abductees about information gathering, or how they see their experiences being information gathering from alien life form, from the sightings of UFOs, you would think that an intelligent life form would do everything they could not to put themselves out there, for want of a better phrase, and have that, give those people those experiences so that they could use it as evidence of existence.
Yes, you're right. But alien abductions of people is it's almost like a separate issue, because what it appears what alien visitors are trying to do with the abductions and a lot of these contact experiences also is they're trying to set up a narrative, one of these many little narratives that they want to set up before revelation happens. And you know, and alien abduction is a perfect case of them going through this theater where they stalk people, they go after people, they take people to this, they transport people to this sort of like a laboratory setting. They take over their ability to resist. It's like a hypnosis sort of situation, and they then make them go through these horrific experiments and so forth. And it's, the whole thing is kind of contrived, alien abductions. And again, I go through this very carefully in my book, The Extra Dimensionals, as to why alien abductions are a theater. They're real. They're real alien visitors doing it to people, like what happened to Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, to many others. But they're unnecessary. there are a theater. And the reason is because the level of technology alien visitors have, they could very easily, they have the ability to manipulate, from what we've seen and from what has been proven, they apparently have the ability to stop time and manipulate time and space. So they don't have to go, they don't have the need to go through this abduction experience. They could just stop time, collect all the samples that they want from people, and disappear. And people wouldn't even know they were there. But they don't do that. They go through this elaborate sort of stalking, targeting, acquiring the person, going through these messages with them, you know, relax, we're, these are peaceful purposes we're here for, you are special. They go through these, this whole kind of theater. And the reason is because they're setting up a narrative. They're setting up a narrative that will be used later in far greater volume. That's the investigative conclusion I came to after studying so many of these authentic abduction cases.
Wow, it's so interesting. Talk and talk. Over the past years, in your experiences working as an investigator, you've now written 3 books. Tell us about your books and how they follow each other. So can we go and we pick up the last book, Clear Hearers, and understand it, or do we need to read all 3?
Oh, well, my main book was talking about today's The Extra Dimensionals. It's basically everything that I have learned concerning the authentic cases of alien abduction, alien contact, and what alien visitor agendas really are at the bottom of everything. And that's something I encourage people to learn about. My latest book is The Clear Hearers. It's really about something completely different. It's actually about a paranormal ability that many people have to hear this authentic, this clear voice of authority that seeks people's benefit, their safety, and their increase. And it's about The Clear Hearers is about, it's a story of investigation. It's a story of my family as I was growing up and all of these paranormal, phenomena that we experienced with the great voice. And it's something that I encourage people to just look at the free sample on Amazon of Clear Hearers. And if they can resist reading more, then that would be really something, because it is something, it's about an experience and an ability that many people have. And it's an explanation of how the phenomena works, how it can benefit them, and how it really can save lives.
And so it's so, different from mediumship. It's different from having a spirit guide, or...
It's different yet similar. So it's that's the amazing part about it. It covers a wide area of experience, because it comes, Clear Hearers is just the English translation of clairaudience, which, as you know, clairaudience is actually a French word that's based on Joan of Arc from 14th century France, the young girl who actually came forward and saved France from going out of existence in 1400s when they were about to be overrun by, they were pretty much overrun by England and were just about to go out of existence. And a great voice came to Joan of Arc and told her exactly what to do and showed her what she needed to do with imagery and visions and even affecting physical outcomes as well. And that's what the Clear Hearers is about the modern, incantation of clear hearing and what it really is in the modern era and how it can help people today.
Quite interesting. When I used to go on stage, I used to ask my guides before I went on to give me the ability to think clearly, to hear clearly, to give my views, give their views across clearly. And that was all about the clairvoyance, clairaudience, and clairtransience that I needed to be able to do my stage event. So it's interesting how I would be asking for clear hearing, and that's the name of your book, Clear Hearing.
Yes, just check it out and just read the free sample on Amazon. It's also available in all book retailers through them and on my website as well, of course, johntamabooks.com. And if you could just look at the free sample, I think you'll see amazingly common experiences in there, Julie.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me this evening. It's been really insightful. I always love speaking to you, so I think you've had such a journey to get to where you are now and to formulate the views that you have, and you know, hours and hours of research. And it's just been incredibly informative. So thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you, Julie. It's my pleasure always being with you. Thank you so much. It's awesome.
Thank you.